Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. Well, we've heard about Governor Jesse Ventura's big plan, his four-part vision for Minnesota. Now the governor is looking at a big conversation. This Wednesday, he'll lead a national town hall meeting live on the Internet. Governor Ventura will take questions from the web audience, and he'll comment on instant polls surveying the viewpoints of an auditorium audience as well. Right now, however, the governor will be taking your questions. There's certainly a lot to talk about. His big plan, the recent trip to Japan, not to mention a recent visit by former third-party presidential candidate John Anderson. Governor Jesse Ventura joins us today in the studio. Hey, thanks for coming by, Governor.
Always a pleasure, Catherine. How are you?
I'm all right.
You're ready to be a big star now by everything I hear. You're going out to Washington and stepping in on that national show, and I heard it's a test market for you.
No, it's a week as a substitute, Governor.
Oh,
I think that if anyone knows about
we in the industry know that different. They don't bring you out there to substitute for, you know, just to substitute you. It's a tryout. Well, it's like getting it's like being a draft pick of sports, you know. You got to go out there then and prove yourself.
Hey, speaking of tryouts, what were you talking to John Anderson about last week at the horse ranch?
John came, he was in town. He's still lecturing in college. Extremely bright man. He's 77, I think, years old now, but still totally on top of it. We came out, he stopped out for about 45 minutes, and we discussed a little third-party politics.
I was just going to say, who was giving who advice there?
Probably a little of both, maybe. I voted for him in 80. You know, I've been a third party advocate for many, many years. And when then Congressman Anderson ran in 80, I supported him at that point in time. And he came out and we had a good conversation. And he told me that I was the natural candidate for president within the third party. But again, as I've stated many times, I have no desire to be the candidate. That's the first thing you got to look at is, do you want to be? And no, I don't. And so from that point on, we moved more to him and wanted to say, and you know, I wanted to see whether there was interest in John Anderson running again. And I found there was a little bit. There's still a, you know, he's got a spark down in the old furnace yet for, I think, national politics a little bit. But again, in like the congressman told me, he said, but you know, he doesn't have the money. Which I find that attractive in some ways when you run into a person that doesn't have the money. But then, of course, you have to figure out a way to get them the money then, because you can't run a national campaign naturally without some financing. So,
well, speaking of money, of course, one of the other names bandied about is Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Now, between, say, a John Anderson and a Donald Trump.
Well, first of all, I'm hoping that at our national convention we have four or five candidates there. I think it's healthy. I think it's healthy for the Reform Party to get bigger and to have, instead of coming in with only Ross Perot. This way, if we go into convention next summer with four or five legitimate candidates, we should get some outstanding debate take place there. And then, you know, the party can then maybe find out what it is or what it wants to be or what direction it wants to go. So if John Anderson desires to run, hey, I'm all for him running. Donald Trump, I'm for Donald Trump running. Pat Buchanan is our only candidate right now who has stated he is, but I personally don't feel that Pat Buchanan is right for our party. The vision that I have for our party is a centrist party, a party that sits in the middle more so than the left or the right, and I don't find Mr. Buchanan to be a middle candidate, a centrist. I find him probably more right than the Republican right.
Now, John Anderson told our Martin Costi, our political reporter, that Trump wasn't your first choice, that you were looking for an alternative. Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, I don't think I have a first choice. Again, I think an accurate assessment is that I would like to see us come in with three or four choices. You know, go into the convention and let all three of them make their case and let he who prevails at the convention come out. And then at that point in time, I'll make my decision.
I know that you have said that you are not the candidate, that you are not running.
No.
You spoke rather movingly in a New York Times Magazine article about how you felt this tearing inside you because you should be the candidate.
Yeah. Deep down inside, I know I'm the logical candidate because I hold the highest office in the party, and I probably have the highest party name recognition now. And it's for the career politician, I would be the candidate. But I don't, first of all, as I said at the outset, Catherine, you got to want the job. And I have no desire to do that job. And one of the big reasons is through what I've learned as being governor, you lose your freedom. You lose it being a governor, and to be a president, you have no freedom. It's really an oxymoron. You're the leader of the free world, yet you personally have no freedom. You can't go anywhere by yourself. You can't do anything without people around you. And people really don't realize how strange that is until it happens to you. And all of a sudden, you can't get up in the morning and just go down to Kmart. You know, and walk in and browse the CD tapes or whatever you feel like doing, or go up to the Dairy Queen and get a malt or whatever. You can't do any of those things anymore without letting security know where you're going or without them accompanying you. And as president, there's no freedom at all to that job. I was out in Washington earlier this year, and we happened to be walking by the White House, and we saw the president and Hillary Clinton go for a backyard stroll. Well, you'd think it'd be kind of nice, you could get away from it all. There was a security person every 15 yards bordering the White House all the way around. These guys standing there in these black uniforms with these strange bags around them, which you know, are protection and all of that. And, you know, imagine that for a moment being your life for 4 years. And I just, at this point in my life, I'm 48 years old. When I'm through being governor, I'll be early 50s or mid 50s if I seek a second term. And at that point in time, I don't want to do that at that point in my life.
We're talking to Governor Jesse Ventura. We're also taking your questions, 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. The governor is going to convene an online national town hall meeting on Wednesday. Think of this as a dry run. He's taking your questions at 651-227-6000 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. We're going to go to Nick. He's calling us from St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning, Governor.
Hi, Nick. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Say, I just had a quick question. Has anybody thought about or even talked to Jack Kemp as a possible candidate?
I haven't. I don't want to get involved that much in national politics. You kind of get drawn into it. The media kind of forces you into it because they continually ask you questions about it. But I really don't want to get that involved in it. Jack Kemp, he ran before. It would be up to him. You know, I think initially it has to come from the candidate. Or it should come from the candidate rather than someone like me or someone in the media just pulling a name up. It should come from the candidate, I think, to make the initial movement if they do desire to run for president or a national office.
Speaking of candidates, Paul Wellstone has been quoted in the Associated Press as saying that he might consider a run for the governorship in 2002. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that Paul Wellstone has become a career politician. You know, at one point he said he wouldn't be when he initially ran for U.S. Senate. He was a professor who was only going to serve one term, and he wasn't going to take PAC money. Well, now he's the biggest PAC money taker in Washington. He's completing his second term, so he has fallen into becoming a career politician. So it wouldn't surprise me if he continued in a political career forever and ever, amen.
I think he only said that he would serve two terms, and he's...
No, he said one initially.
Ah, okay.
When he first ran before he was first elected, it was one term.
Well, if anyone could certainly be empathetic, could understand what would happen to you once you get into that situation of power, I mean, don't you have some understanding of how he might change his mind?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. But I don't understand how he changed his mind on PAC money. You know, to me, that I will never accept PAC money. I will stay with my promise to do so, so that no one owns me. See, once you accept PAC money and special interest money, then you're owned by those people. They're not giving it to you, Catherine, because they like your looks, or giving it to you because you're a nice guy. They're buying influence with you. And the senator is one of the biggest special interest takers of money that there is out there now.
What is it that makes a career politician? For instance, if you ran for another term as governor, would that make you a career politician?
Not necessarily, no. What would make me, my definition of a career politician is serving over two terms and then never going back to the private sector. See, my belief in what term limits should be, you should be allowed to serve, let's throw the Senate terms out, because I think personally that all terms should be 4 years. That Congress should be 4 years, governor 4 years, president 4 years, senator 4 years, but somehow we got this 6 and 2 in the equation. I think that 2 4-year terms, and then you should be required to go back to the private sector for at least 2 years so that you can get your feet wet back in reality of what real life is out there before you would ever serve again. So I would say 2 4-year terms and then back to the private sector.
We're going to go to Dave in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you. Hi, Governor.
Hi, Dave.
I just wanted to say that I think I've been very impressed by the things you've said and done regarding transportation in the state. You've appointed a good person. You've said some very common sense things. My question for you is this. I've read recently that some Republicans in the House are saying some real bizarre and, I think, backwards statements regarding transportation and specifically light rail, and they want to stop it. And one of the greatest things I think you did was, enable light rail to finally happen. Can they stop it, and will you find a way to stop them?
Well, I certainly hope they can't stop it. I mean, first of all, I think it's very short-sighted on all their parts. I mean, it passed the House, it passed the Senate, I signed it, it's over, move on. And yet now they took a posture of trying to go out and, excuse the pun, derail it in Washington, which I think is horrible, because it shows, it then undermines what we're trying to do here and how our government here in Minnesota passed a bill and it should move forward, and now they're taking a secondary route of trying to stop it in Washington, which, you know, if we don't get this transportation funding, rest assured it'll go to another state. It's not going to, you know, they're not going to give it back to us in another form. They're not going to give it to us to do something else with. It's going to go to another state. And we sit in a great position right now nationally because we have both Congressman Szabo and Congressman Oberstar who are very high on the Transportation Committee. They have the ability to get federal funding to Minnesota, and we need to take advantage of that. And I'm a believer in rail because we've been dragging our feet and studying it now for 20 years, and every year that you study it, the price gets higher and higher, and it'll be harder and harder to do. And why should transportation be looked at as only a person being able to get into a car?
Well, of course, speaking of the price getting higher and higher, what concerns, of course, some people is the fact that even after passing this legislation, the estimates keep getting higher and higher.
But they do, Catherine, on anything. On a highway project, that you can only go off the estimates that you received. We were going off 97. Those were the figures that we had, but we made it very clear, of course, that these will not be the final price, because by the time the rail gets built, we'll be going off about a 2002 estimate at that point. It's that way on a highway project. When they pass a highway project, they'll come in with an initial set of dollars at that point in time, but by the time the project gets approved, gets on the agenda, the contracts are let, and everything else goes out, the price naturally will go higher.
What about those people who would say, look, we have so much congestion, it's better to spend this money on the roads?
It's good to spend it on everything. You have to go at transportation as transportation. It isn't just roads, because there isn't one city in America that has built their way out of congestion. What you try to do is provide alternative transportation choices. That's what you're out to do. You're out to, and let's look at it this way. We've got baby boomers who are going to become elderly very shortly. You and I probably fit in that in a couple of years. We're not there yet. But and this is not a slight upon the elderly, but do we want them driving cars? Or would we prefer to get them a way to get around without having to get in an automobile, without having to go out on a freeway, and basically take their life in their own hands and everyone else if they're not capable at an elderly age of being able to drive on a freeway? I mean, let's face it, you got to be right there faculty-wise and reaction-wise, instinct-wise, and everything like that to drive the freeways today. I would sooner see us provide alternative transportation methods that would allow the elderly, and you're going to see an influx back into the city, too. You're seeing this sprawl happen now. Everybody wants the five-acre lot out in suburbia. Well, when you get in your 60s, do you want to be mowing that lawn? I don't think so. I think you're going to see an influx back into the cities. That is, if we can prepare the cities to be a good place to move to again. Transportation, public safety, all of that has to come into the equation.
The fact that the House Republicans are...
Not all of them. Don't lump them all in there. There are plenty of House Republicans who support rail.
Well, then let me rephrase this. It strikes, I think, some observers that there are some Republicans, maybe even some Democrats, who see you as more vulnerable than the last session. The fact that they're trying to repeal the light rail project.
Well, they can see me as vulnerable as they want to see me. If they want to override a veto of mine, they're certainly entitled to do so. That's how the system works. But ultimately, remember, they're all up for election this coming fall. I'm not. So, if they want to go against me and if the people support what I'm doing, well, then they'll be the ones that'll face the electorate out there. But that's politics. And if they override a veto, I don't have a problem with that. That's their choice.
We're going to go to Donald in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Donald.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Governor.
Hi, Donald. How are you?
First, I'm doing great. I wanted to commend you as the only governor of the state of Minnesota that has actually given money back to the taxpayers. I believe it was a job well done, and I personally thank you.
Thank you. Well, I campaigned on that and said very clearly that I would give the money back. It's over taxation, and we'll continue to do so.
Well, the question I wanted to ask you, Your Honor, is that I'm concerned about the effect of the walleye dispute between Ontario and Minnesota on the northwest angle. And I wanted to ask you if there's any further developments in the negotiations with the Ontario government on resolving the dispute between our state and Ontario.
Well, first, I think it has been pretty well resolved. I know if we're speaking of the same thing, there was the problem of Ontario made you stay in a Canadian hotel in which to fish and on the Canadian side of the waters. That's been solved. That's no longer. Ontario has agreed to allow Minnesotans to stay in hotels on our side of the border now. I don't know if it's something bigger on that little northwest corner up there. That's a strange banana anyway when you look at it. How did we ever end up with that little chunk of land that is totally waterlocked away from our state? We own one little piece of land up there that has a big lake around it, and the only way you can get to it is via Canada. Do you know that?
No, Catherine.
I have no idea how we ended up with that little chunk of land up there. But, hopefully things are working out very well right now. We reached a compromise with Ontario on the fishing. They agreed to allow Minnesotans now to stay on our side of the border and fish on their side of the water, and that was a big step. And if there's any more problems, I'm sure they can be worked out.
We're going to go to Zev in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Zev.
Hey there.
Hi.
My question for Jesse is, why doesn't he just stop that Highway 55 reroute?
Why should I stop it?
Well, it is the oldest park in America.
It's not going to destroy the park.
It's going to damage a good chunk of it.
No, it's not. I grew up in that neighborhood. That's my neighborhood. They came in and took out all the houses along that Hiawatha corridor 30-some years ago, and then it sat there for 30 years because of, I don't know why, lack of funding, whatever it might be. And it's not going to destroy the park. It the park will continue to be there. And, you know, it's a case that it's been approved by all facets of government. It's been approved in every court case, has given it the go-ahead. And at this point in time, I don't think I could stop it even if I wanted to.
We're going to go to Rose in Clearwater. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Rose.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Governor Ventura. Are
Hi,
you there?
Rose. Yes, I sure am.
Say, I'm calling because recently you signed a reorganization order to move victim services into the Department of Public Safety, and I've always appreciated your position about asking the people what they want, and this move seemed to be done without considering the input of, like, the battered women's and sexual assault movements who are very opposed to the move.
Why?
Because one of the first things that Charlie Weaver did was he eliminated the state battered women's and sexual assault offices and the crime and the advisory councils that have guided the development of some of the, you know, the national models relative to domestic violence and battered women. And so we're very concerned about losing our voice and the fact that it was done without considering the objections or what was really going on that prompted that move.
Well,
you know, like, for, let me just say this. You,
all right.
You speak about, you know, let the people decide, and I really support
No. You can't let the people decide everything. That, otherwise, why would I be elected, and why would we have elected officials?
Right, right.
You know, you elect us to make decisions also.
Yes, and but in this particular instance, it seems like it was done in the name of streamlining and saving money. But what we know is that it's probably not going to do that. And wondering if you'd be willing to meet with a number of us from the battered women's and sexual assault coalitions to talk about some of the repercussions. If nothing else, you know, the fact that this department eliminated our offices is going to have widespread repercussions for all of us.
Well, let's wait and see the outcome first, because it could be handled in a different manner before you make a determination that all of a sudden it's been eliminated. I will talk to Charlie Weaver, Commissioner Weaver, and we'll be happy to meet with you. No problem.
Now, let's talk for a minute in terms of things that the people decide, things that the people elect.
Mm-hmm.
Governors and other officials to decide. You are in favor of a unicameral legislature.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people who would say that one of the reasons why we need two houses is that we do need people to make decisions for us.
And you will still have it with unicameral. You'll have better decision-making with unicameral because you will have, first of all, Catherine, what we need to look at is putting it on the ballot. You don't want to put the cart in front of the horse. We can argue which is better, unicameral or bicameral and all that, but ultimately right now my position is let's put it on the ballot for next fall. Then once it's on the ballot, let both sides make their case, and that is democracy at its finest. We will both sides, bicameral will be out there making their case, unicameral will make their case, the people of Minnesota will decide what they want their government to be constitutionally going into the new millennium, and to me it's healthy. No matter which way wins, it's healthy to have those kind of discussions out there. And so, and if the people who support bicameral, if it's indeed the best, then why won't they put it out there and let the people decide whether it's the best? If it's truly the best, it'll prevail, won't it?
Are you sure that's necessarily the best way to have that discussion?
Yeah.
To have that debate?
Yes.
Why?
Because I think the people, 5 out of 6 of the past governors support unicameral. It has tripartisan support. There's Democrats who support it. There's Republicans who support it. There's Reform Party people who support it. Therefore, shouldn't it be a decision made by the public? It should not be made by the legislature, because the legislature has a conflict of interest. Because if unicameral does prevail, there'll be about 60-some of them that will be eliminated. Well, that, you know, how can you have someone who's has that type of conflict of interest be making a decision like that?
We are talking to Governor Jesse Ventura, and we will, of course...
Let's stay with Unicameral.
Well, no, we're going to. We just have to take a quick news break. Oh, are you kidding? I've got tons more questions about that, Governor. Don't worry about that. We are talking to Governor Jesse Ventura. He will be having a big conversation this Wednesday. He'll be convening a national town hall meeting online. If you're interested in that, you can go to it Wednesday at jesse.mnmeeting.com. But if you have questions for the governor right now, as we've just noted, we're talking about his idea for a unicameral legislature. There's tons of things we haven't even touched on yet. We've got that trip to Japan. We can still take your calls about Reform Party politics. Question for the governor? You bring it right here. It's 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities and you'd like to join our conversation, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We're going to turn now to Greta Cunningham. She's standing by with the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.
Thank you, Catherine, and good morning. Officials in Seattle are bracing to deal with thousands of protesters at the World Trade Organization conference. Seattle authorities have shut off the utilities to an abandoned apartment building occupied by protesters. They are also barring anyone from taking lumber and nails into the building to prevent demonstrators from building barricades. A new era is beginning in Northern Ireland, where rival parties have gathered to form a governing coalition of Protestants and Catholics. The Northern Ireland Assembly is meeting to decide who will hold which positions in a 12-member executive cabinet. A Norwegian official says the high-speed ferry that sank off Norway's west coast Friday may have broken rules against sailing in rough weather. The official says the ferry was only certified to sail in 3-foot waves, while the waves Friday night were between 6 and 10 feet high. The boat sank 45 minutes after running aground, killing at least 16 people. The death of the popular giant panda at Washington's National Zoo leaves just 5 pandas in U.S. zoos, 3 in San Diego and 2 in Atlanta. Sing Sing was put to sleep yesterday because of the effects of kidney disease. In regional news, U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone says he's reconsidering his pledge not to seek a third term in office. Wellstone, a DFLer, was elected in 1990 and 1996 and had pledged to seek just 2 terms. But he's reconsidering because he wants to be part of the Senate if the Democrats reclaim the majority and a Democrat is elected president next year. Wellstone also says he would consider running for governor of Minnesota in 2002, although he's not ready to make a commitment. Wellstone's current term ends in 2002. The forecast for the state of Minnesota calls for partly cloudy skies statewide. High temperatures today ranging from 25 in the northeast near Duluth to 45 in the southwest. At this hour, mostly sunny skies reported around the region. Rochester reports sunshine at 23. It's sunny in St. Cloud and 18. And in the Twin Cities, mostly sunny skies, a temperature of 25. Catherine, that's a look at the latest news.
Thanks, Greta.
Some of the strongest voices in your community, business, and government are those of NPR listeners. Want to be heard? Get your message out to the community by becoming an NPR program sponsor. Call Sherry Davis at 651-290-1496.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning here on Minnesota Public Radio. We're continuing our conversation with Governor Jesse Ventura. And, of course, we're continuing that conversation with your calls and questions. There's a lot to talk about here. We're talking about the unicameral legislature. We're talking about the governor's recent trip to Japan, talking about the national town hall meeting that he'll be convening online at jesse.mnmeeting.com on Wednesday. But if you have a question for right now, it's 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Well, Governor, I promised you that we would get back to our conversation on your idea for the unicameral legislature. Now, you know that that idea has some national critics. George Will, not necessarily your biggest fan, has said that the idea of streamlining government actually isn't good, that if you believe in less government, limited government, that's why a bicameral legislature works.
Yeah, and he also said gridlock is good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we can disagree. I think that unicameral, yes, at the national level, there's no doubt about it. You need bicameral. You must have bicameral.
Why does it work at the national, the federal level,
because,
but not at the state?
Because if you had unicameral at a national level, states like California would carry all the power because they would have the majority of the representation. But if you look at it at the state level, both Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin supported unicameral. You look at it at the local level, then why don't we have bicameral city councils? Why don't we have bicameral county commissions? Why don't we have two of them and let them meet in conference then and iron out their differences? Why don't we have it at all levels of government? You don't need it at state government either. I think one of the major reasons for unicameral is accountability. Every legislator then will be accountable for their vote on the open house floor. Any amendments to a bill will be done by the full legislature on the open house floor, not done in these conference committees. Right now, you have, if you notice, the people, many of the people who oppose unicameral are the power brokers, those elected officials that have been there 25 years that carry the power. Because right now, if you're a newly elected representative, you carry virtually hardly any power over there at all. And there should not be. You still represent the same amount of people as what an old-timer does, and yet the old-timer carries all the power and the newly elected official carries virtually hardly any. And I want to level that playing field more, because ultimately they both represent the same amount of people. Why should one group of people be represented more than another group of people?
Well, what about the argument that a one-house legislature is actually makes the pickings easier for lobbyists?
It makes it much harder. Makes it harder.
How so?
Well, because right now all you have to do is get to one person. If you're a lobbyist and you get to the conference committee head, that conference committee head can stop any bill from seeing the light.
Let's do a statewide civics lesson. Let's explain to folks who maybe aren't familiar with this arcana what a conference committee is.
Well, a conference committee is a committee set up by the two partisan political groups, and one in the House, one in the Senate, and then you have a combined one in the end, the final conference committee, which is a combination of hand-picked legislators from both the House and the Senate, generally based on seniority, again, who's been there the longest. And then there's a conference committee head, the chair. Well, the chair has such power in these conference committees that if one person decides a bill will not be heard, that person can do it. The chair of the conference committee can determine whether a bill sees the light of day or doesn't. And like, take for example, during the governor debates last year, a big hot topic during the debates was conceal and carry, whether you should have the right to carry a concealed weapon or not. Well, finally, towards the end of the debates, I started saying, why are you wasting our time with this? Because you have a conference committee head who will never let this bill see the light of day. It'll never see the governor's desk. So why are you bothering to ask us this? In our current system, if one committee head decides that this particular bill in their committee, they don't like it for whatever their personal reasons, they can choose not to hear it. So going back to your lobbyists, all the lobbyist has to do is get to that committee head. And if they can influence that committee head not to hear the bill, then it doesn't see the light of day.
But you still would have fewer people to try to lobby in a one-house legislature.
But you don't have to lobby all them, Catherine. You only have to lobby the committee people.
Well, I don't
That's
know.
All
it
that
seems
has
like
to
there's
be
an
lobbied.
Awful lot of lobbyists over there at Capitol Hill now.
They're lobbying all the committee leaders. You know, but see, the thing is, the other thing that'll be unique and unicameral is every legislator will have a priority bill that will have to be voted on. One, you get one a session, which will be voted on by the body. So you know what that means? You could actually see them vote on term limits. If one legislator names that he or she's priority bill, they would then have to vote term limits up or down. You notice term limits never see the light of day, even though they take polls and 80-some percent of the people favor them. It never sees the light of day because it never gets out of committee.
You have said that you would actively work against legislators you would work to defeat legislators who wouldn't put the unicameral issue on the ballot.
Yes.
And some people have taken that as a threat.
It's not a threat, it's politics.
What's
Why is
difference?
It a threat? Because I believe strongly that this is a decision that should be made by the people. And again, I've told you, conflict of interest. You've got legislators over there that don't want to see the people vote on this, just like you have them that don't want to see people vote on term limits. The same thing. And I will actively work against them because this demands to be put on the ballot. Five out of the last six governors support unicameral. Your leadership over there in the legislative, very much support amongst the leadership over there. This is a decision that the people of Minnesota, I'll give you an example. We were up in Fergus Falls at a legislative hearing last week. And I got through speaking, and I turned to the public. I said, let's take an informal survey to the crowd of over 700. I said, how many people support unicameral? And a bunch of hands went up. I said, how many support bicameral? A bunch of hands went up. I said, how many people here do not, I repeat, do not support the right of you, the people, to make this decision? Not one hand went up. Not one in the entire auditorium went up.
We're going to go to Lewis in Rochester. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Lewis.
Hello, good morning. Thank you, Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
Governor, thank you for sending some money back to my family, and half of that went to help people in the Rochester area.
Well, good for you, Lewis.
And the reason I'm calling also, Governor, is I've raised all my children to participate in the great Minnesota experience of the outdoors, whether that's fishing or skiing or hunting or biking or kayaking. And Governor, the DNR seems to be in trouble. It needs financial help. It needs other help.
Yep.
I would like to hear what you can do to help. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, I tried to last year. We supported the raising of the fees for hunting and fishing, which I supported, and the legislature, again, wouldn't hear it. They, for whatever reason, chose not to do it. I certainly hope we'll revisit it this legislative session, because when you really look, let's take a fishing license. It is a heck of a deal when you think about it, because you can buy a family fishing license today. I think it's $21.50. I might be wrong by a buck or two, but if memory serves me correctly, it's $21.50. Now, a family of four, what does it cost you to go to the movies today? If you go out and you go to one of the current run flicks out there, it'll cost you probably $50 or $35 by the time you're through buying your tickets, buying some popcorn and snacks and whatever else you do there. Yet you can buy a family fishing license for $21.50 that allows you, if you desire, to fish 365 days of the year. Now that is cheap. And if we raise that a dollar or two, that is not going to break the bank with anyone. I have a lot of friends that are avid hunter and fishermen, and like they've said to me, what's a couple bucks? That's a beer. You know, that's like when you're done fishing, you walk in and you drink a beer. And as long as they know that that money is going to go for what it's being assessed for, and that is the wildlife and the hunting and fishing in Minnesota, they have no problem with it. So I will again support the raising of the fees on the license, because I'm a great believer in user fees. I believe in very strongly in that the people that use something should help fund it. And as far as hunting and fishing goes, it's very, very cheap. It's one of the best deals you can possibly get in this state for what you get out of it. And if it goes up a buck or two, it's not going to break the bank with anyone.
We are talking to Governor Jesse Ventura. You've heard about his big plan for the state of Minnesota. On Wednesday, he has the big conversation. He will be convening a national town hall meeting online. Now, if you want to take part in this national town hall meeting, you go to the website and you pre-register. It's jesse.mnmeeting.com. Again, jesse.mnmeeting.com. You can also listen to this National Town Hall meeting this Wednesday from noon to 1 here on Minnesota Public Radio. Meanwhile, the governor is sort of taking a dry run of that National Town Hall meeting with a state town hall meeting. It's an open hour. He's taking your calls, your questions at 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. If you're in the Twin Cities and you have a question for the governor, it's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. We're going to go to Patrick in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning, Patrick.
Hi, Catherine. I want to thank you so much for a great program that you put on every day.
Thanks.
And also, hello, Mr. Ventura.
Hi, how are you?
Great. I have a question for you. Is NPR still on your agenda to revoke funding? Are you still planning on revoking funding for public radio and public television?
Well, that's one of the positions that I support. Yes, I think that they can make it on their own. They get barely any of their budget now from public funding, and it's a matter of principle. Why should one radio station receive subsidy dollars from the government? Either that or let's subsidize them all. You know, let's give the other station some public money, too, then. Would you agree?
Well, I guess I agree. I don't agree, I guess.
Why? I mean, it's a case of competition. Then you and I can disagree. If you think that one station deserves public funding over another station, I don't understand what your criteria is.
I guess I feel that public radio and public television is for the public good as opposed to make a buck here and there.
For the public good, but they're out. I mean, there's a lot of people that make a lot of money in these places. I don't think Garrison Keillor's hurting for a buck right now. He gets very wealthy off it.
It's true, but hours like this, I don't think you can find anywhere else on public radio or public, or anywhere else
right.
Not on public radio.
Well, I'm probably not going to go very far with it because even the Republicans support it. So, you know, it's just my personal opinion. I just think that if you're going to subsidize one, you should subsidize them all.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Patrick, I thought you knew why we had the Northwest angle.
That's right.
Oh,
I forgot about that.
Why do we have it, Patrick?
Yeah.
Tell me.
Yeah, sure. Jesse, actually what it was a surveyor's mistake. Back in the early part of the territory when they were surveying for the state boundaries, it was a mistake.
How the heck could they make a mistake? It's all surrounded by water.
I have no idea.
No, one could, of course, posit the notion that maybe these were the same people who did the streets of St. Paul. But we're not going to go
there. Could be.
We are going to go to Dale in Rochester. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Dale.
Hi. I can't help asking the question about unicameral, the unicameral legislature. In your book, you describe your experience Brooklyn Park or Brooklyn Center?
Brooklyn Park.
City council is not really too favorable in the beginning, and my question is, why should we go unicameral statewide
Well, because you have more checks and balances statewide. When they tell you you need bicameral for checks and balances, no, you don't. You have them already built in between the judicial, the legislative, and the executive branches of government. You have three checks and balances that were set up by our forefathers to give you checks and balances. And unicameral, you will still have the checks and balances there of people being voting up or down on the issues, and they'll vote them on the open floor so that you'll see how the person that represents you actually voted all the time. And it'll be that way for amendments also. See, right now, when a bill comes out of final conference committee, they can put any amendments onto that bill that they want to. They can put amendments on there that have virtually nothing to do with that bill. And when it comes out of that final conference committee, the legislature is only allowed to vote it up or down. They can't vote on any individual amendments that have been added to it. That's where you get people putting on their pork. You know, they want to bring something home to the local district, and they have the power in that conference committee, and they'll make a deal, and they'll say, okay, I'll do this for you. You let me get this amendment on the bill. And then when the bill comes out to the voting of the whole legislative body, they have to simply vote it up or down, and that puts them at a dilemma. Now, maybe the original bill is outstanding, but maybe it's been flooded with a bunch of amendments that are worthless, or someone would deem them worthless. Well, they have to make a decision then. Well, do I sacrifice the good of the whole bill and vote against it, or do I vote for the good initial bill and allow all these other things to tag along with it because of the overriding factor of the initial bill? And see, unicameral will eliminate all that.
The unicameral legislature is part of your big plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got these four planks, and one of them is self-sufficiency.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk for a minute about what state services or state agencies get in the way of the self-sufficiency of people here?
Well, I think that in a lot of ways, agriculture could be one. We need to work as a government in support of our people, not necessarily against them or putting obstacles up in front of them. And when I talk about self-sufficiency, what I mean there is I talk about people taking it upon themselves to get results and not necessarily looking to the government immediately for an answer. I think a prime example is what happened, and here we can do a great segue, Catherine, into Japan. Works perfect. A prime example is what took place on the pork industry, where you had 80 family farmers down in Pipestone, Minnesota, band together. They're still family farmers. They, in turn, bought the Ellison Meat Packing Company. So they not only now raise the pork, they also process it. They then, with us, went over and finished a deal with a company, a private sector company in Japan, to where now 40,000 pounds of pork per week will be shipped right from Minnesota directly to Japan. And that's a great example of self-sufficiency, of people taking the initiative of not looking to their government for the answer every time a problem comes about, for people themselves to say, hey, here's a problem we're facing, let's get together and figure out a solution to it, and then have government work in support of that solution. And that's what I'm talking about in self-sufficiency, is for people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and not necessarily turn to the government immediately for the answer.
There was an interesting poll in the Star Tribune done last month. A majority of people thought that you're a strong leader, that you side with the average citizen, that you're in tune with the state on issues, but only 38% thought that you sympathized with the poor.
That I sympathize with the poor?
Mm-hmm.
What is sympathizing with the poor? Give me the definition. What is that?
Well, you know, the poll didn't provide a definition, but there seemed, I remember from the article, that they said that there seemed to be a perception that when you talk about self-sufficiency and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, that sometimes you're looking at people in lower incomes and saying, hey, it's your job to pull yourself up.
It is. It absolutely is. There's an old saying that says you can only help people that want to help themselves. If you can't help someone that doesn't want to help themselves, and that's why the initiative does have to come from you as an individual. You have to want to succeed before government can even begin to help you succeed.
Can you want to succeed but maybe need just a helping hand?
Sure, certainly.
A little tuition here?
I think that you'll find, Catherine, that my budget was the best budget for public schools have seen in many, many, many years. I'm a product of public schools. I believe in them, and I believe that every young child should have a fair chance to get an education and that they shouldn't have to go to a private school to get one, that we should be able to provide a public education for them. But I also believe in accountability. I believe that if you make mistakes, that you are ultimately responsible for those mistakes and that you can't automatically turn to the government and say, well, gee, I made a mistake. When I had a chance to go to school, I didn't pay attention. I flunked out of school. I didn't get my diploma. So now it's the government's job to make sure that I succeed in life. No, it's not. It's your job to make sure you succeed.
We're going to go to Michael in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Well, good morning, Governor Ventura. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Michael.
I have a question for you in regards to the license tabs.
Uh-huh.
I was just curious as to what the thought process behind making them a flat fee of $75 is. My thought is that I have a lot of trouble finding pity in my heart for someone who's driving an $80,000 SUV down the freeway and causing a lot more wear on the highways and
whoa, whoa, whoa,
like
wait,
that.
Wait, Michael.
Okay.
First of all, why should you be penalized? You're already penalized when you buy that vehicle. You pay a higher sales tax. So you've been penalized already. If you want to spend a lot for a vehicle, if you want to spend $80,000 for an automobile, you're penalized by higher sales tax. Why then, okay, let's take a hunter or a fisherman. Should they pay more because they have a more expensive shotgun or fishing pole?
Well,
should that mean they pay a higher price? You're paying for the use of the highway. That's all you're paying for. And to me, philosophically, it should be a flat rate. It should not matter if you're driving a Ferrari, a $200,000 Ferrari, or if you're driving an old beater that's leaking oil and polluting the atmosphere. Why should it should be a flat rate? What you're doing, Mike, is you're paying for the use of the privilege to drive on the road. Why should it matter one way, shape, or form what you're driving?
Well, there's an argument to be said about the weight of vehicles as compared to their relative cost and the license tab fees they're from.
But they're not based upon weight.
Well,
they're based upon what you pay for the car. And you want to see another fraudulent example of it, Mike? I'll give you another one.
Okay.
I own a 1990 Porsche, which is now 10 years old. Well, that car is still worth $32,500, but I only have to pay $78 now because it's gotten to the point where it doesn't go off the value of the car. It's because the car's 10 years old. And so even though it costs more than a Ford Explorer, a brand new one, the Ford Explorer will pay probably $400 and some a year to drive, where my Porsche is actually worth more money if we were to sell both of them. And yet I only pay $78 now. See, it's a fraudulent system that, to me, a flat rate across the board, it shouldn't matter if it's a car. If it's a truck, fine. You pay a different rate for a truck, different rate for a car, and all of that. Semis would pay differently, naturally, than private automobiles. But it should not be based upon the price of the car.
I want to get back to your travels, because you're thinking of traveling to Mexico next on a trade mission? Now, there was a recent piece in the Star Tribune by someone who's worked in trade for a long time who pointed out that we actually have more of a trade relationship with some countries in Europe. So I'm wondering if you're also thinking of Britain, France, Germany?
Yeah. I got 3 more years, you know, and so I've got time to do them all.
You're thinking Paris in 2001?
Maybe. But I think Mexico is very important to us right now. Right now, we don't even have a trade office down there. And most all of the other Midwestern states all do. And they're right now, I think, 12th or 14th trading partner with us. Canada's first. Japan is second. Mexico's down 12 to 14. I find that a little strange that a border country to the United States would be that low. And I think that it's a country with a lot of potential around the corner that we in Minnesota need to be tapping into.
We have a legislative session coming up. Do you think that your Playboy interview has hurt you in terms of how you'll be dealing with the legislators? I mean, some of them, it sounded like they were getting ready to attack.
Let them attack. I've been attacked before. I simply ask people this. I probably do 25 interviews a week, and certainly I'm going to goof up and say something in one that's a personal opinion. Don't judge me by whatever my personal opinions are. Judge me by how I govern. Judge me by what I do over in that office over there. Certainly I have opinions that may not be all mainstream all the time, but there's nothing wrong with that either. That's the great thing about America, is that minority opinion can still be looked at and be given. I have freedom of speech. I don't think I've lost the First Amendment right just because I've been elected. And if I offended people, I don't mean to offend people. My biggest fault, Catherine, is that when I'm asked a question, I try to answer it.
Well, here's the last question.
Okay.
Obviously, you are the most well-known governor we've ever had. And with your celebrity around the country, you've come to define Minnesota. Someone says Minnesota, and people think Governor Jesse Ventura. Is that a good thing?
Yes.
Why?
Oh, because why not?
You define the state?
Not me necessarily, but to have people think of the state. I think that now when businesses go to Japan and they say, well, yes, we're a business from Minnesota, boom, a light's going to go off over there. Oh, Minnesota. And I think that's a great thing. I mean, why shouldn't we be? We're the best state in the country. And I'll say that straightforward right now. We're the best in the country, and we take the lead on many, many things, and we'll continue to take the lead.
All right, Governor Ventura, we're out of time. I want to thank you for
thank
being
you,
here.
Thank you, Catherine, and good luck out in Washington.
Thanks
we
a
might
lot.
Lose you, huh?
I don't think
then,
so.
Then Gary Eichten will be doing 4 hours here a day.
All right. You're listening.